Okay, we're going to begin our study from the book of Revelation this morning. We're going to be in chapter 2. For those who were unable to be here last week, we did our introduction in chapter 1 where John was given his commission to write the book of Revelation. And John heard this voice behind him, like said, like a voice of mighty rivers, and he turned around and saw the first vision that we're going to see in the book of Revelation, and that was this figure of this individual who was completely white with a white hair and a white robe, and of course, with our symbolism from the book of Revelation, we know that represents purity. Let's just turn over there and take a look at that passage once again, because I want to look at that one more time so that we can understand exactly who we're talking about here. This is in chapter 1. It starts about verse 9, okay? He says, I, John, your brother and partner in the tribulation and the kingdom of the with patient endurance that are in Jesus, was on the Isle of Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in the book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, okay, let's listen to this description now. I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, one like the Son of God. Now, this is the only vision that's going to give its own interpretation, because if you go down to the latter part of the chapter, he tells us there the seven lampstands are the seven churches, and the seven stars are angels of the seven churches. Okay, now let's go and look at this description. Okay, verse 13. And in the midst of the lampstand, one like a son of man, clothed with a long white robe and with a golden sash around his chest. His hairs of his head were white like wool, like snow. His eyes were like flames of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in a furnace. And his voice was like the roar of many waters. And in his right hand he held seven stars, and from his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. Now, if you just sat down and read that, and nobody told you who this was, you could figure that out by yourself, couldn't you? Who is this talking to John? This is Christ. This is the Son of God, okay? I don't think anybody could misunderstand that. He goes on down here a little bit further, and he says, fear not. This is in the latter part of verse 17. Fear not, for I am the first and the last, the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Does anybody else fit that description? No, none whatsoever. Okay? And so as he begins to address these seven churches, he's going to use these different figures that he gave us over there to address himself to each of these seven churches. Okay? It's interesting that these letters to these seven churches are really, they seem like they're out of place, because the rest of the book is written in apocryphal language, but these are not. These are just in plain common sense language. And really, you could pull chapter 2 and 3 out of the book of Revelation and read right through the book, and it really would make no difference whatsoever. But there has to be a purpose for these letters to these seven churches to be in here. Why would they be there? They were probably written separately and then put in there. You know, John, well, he was told what to write and he wrote them, and then they were put in there. Okay. But they're a part of the book of Revelation. We have no indication whatsoever that seven letters were written and sent to seven churches. They're part of the book. He says, write the letters, put them in a book, and then send the book. Okay. So the first evidence we see of them receiving these letters are in the book. Okay. So why do we have these letters? Okay. That's exactly why the book of Revelation was written. Okay. Now, these seven churches are going through exactly what we talked about in the first lesson, about how the persecution was just really ramping up, and how they were not being allowed to buy and sell in the marketplaces. Their kids were being mocked, you know, and you can see graffiti writing on the walls and so on and so forth. All this was going on, and it's just now really ramping up. Okay. And one of the reasons why is because we've got this guy in Rome now who wants to be worshipped as a god while he's alive. Up until this time, Caesars were never viewed as gods until after they passed away. Okay. In fact, Augustus, I believe it was Augustus Caesar, who was the one who got, no, I believe it was Julius, just about 4 weeks after he died, okay, there was a comet that went across the sky, and the people in Rome took that as a sign that Julius Caesar was in heaven enthroned as a god. Okay. And so, that's just, but at that time, it was after they were dead, and they didn't really enforce it upon the other people. But now we've got this guy that comes up on the scene, and he's ruling on the throne, named Domitian, and he didn't want to wait. So he said, we're just going to worship me while I'm alive. Okay. So now it's really starting to ramp up. Interesting passage. I thought about this as we were reading through and studying some of this material. But something I remembered from a sermon I heard a long time ago, and I don't even remember who preached the sermon, but the thought stuck with me. Over in the book of Jeremiah, Chapter 12, it's very, very interesting over there. Jeremiah is known as the weeping prophet, okay? He's one of those guys that walked around Babylon during the Babylonian captivity. He was a prophet in that time. One of those guys that walked around, you know, oh, why me? Why me? You know, that type of attitude, okay? Something very interesting over in chapter 12, starting in verse 1. This is Jeremiah. He says, righteous are you, O God, and when I complain to you, yet I would plead my case before you. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? You plant them, they take root, they grow and produce fruit. You are near to their mouths and far from their hearts. And you can read on there the same thing, you know, wham, 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 why me, why me, why me. But look what happens down when God gives him an answer in verse 5, okay? I have raced, or if you have raced with men on foot and they have wearied you, how will you compete with horses? You get the message? You know, that's kind of like saying, you know, if you couldn't handle the foot soldiers, what are you going to do when the cavalry comes? Okay. So in other words, God was telling Jeremiah, Jeremiah, it's going to get worse. Okay. And that's why this book was written to these people, to tell them that things are going to get worse. Okay. It's bad now, but it's going to get worse, you know. And you need to remain faithful. That's what it's all about. So I just thought that was interesting. I don't know why that came to my mind, but I thought about it when I was studying this material. But I think there's another reason why these letters were written. And that's for our benefit. Okay? Because one thing that it does for us is it gives us some insight into first century Christianity. Okay? I can look at those churches and I can see what they were dealing with back then. You know what I see in all of that? Situations might have changed, but really everything is the same today as it always has been. Okay? These people had needs. They had some problems, okay? But the biggest problem was spirituality. And that's never changed. And that's the same with us. The problems may have changed, but the real problem is spirituality, right? God is warning them to remain faithful. Okay? So this sheds some light for us, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, what kind of light we see from all this. But there is a theory, and I hesitate to mention all these things because I don't want us to talk about all these theories and stuff because there's so many of them out there. But there is a theory that says the seven letters are examples of periods in church history. In other words, this is what we call the continuous historical theory, and that is that Revelation is being revealed to us, you know, out through history. It's not past, you know. It's kind of, well, it's past, present, and future is what it amounts to. And so they look at these letters to these churches and say each church represents a period in church history. Okay. Now, I'm not going to get into the problems with all that. I think you could see through that right now without having to get into it. And I don't want to take a lot of time doing it. But if you take that philosophy, you can make the Scripture say almost anything you want to. You know, we hear people say, well, look, they said that over in Revelation, didn't they? You know, we're told that. This is the fulfillment of that prophecy over in Revelation. And you know, And if it's already been said, it's happening, it happens again, they say, well, we've got a double fulfillment. In other words, what I'm saying is you can make it say whatever you want to say. And then we miss the idea of what Revelation is all about. So I'm just mentioning that there is such a theory, but we don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that. Okay, here's the idea. The problems that existed in the first century church and the problems that exist for us today, where do they come from? Where do problems come from? They come from ourselves. They come from our sins, our own weaknesses, our own ignorance, those types of things, okay? That has never changed. Okay, that has never changed. So I think that what Revelation, these letters are telling us, is the fact that, you know, it's been a problem when the church was first established. It's still a problem today, and it will always be a problem. However, in spite of all these problems, the church is still here. It's always going to be here. Okay, it's not going away. God is in charge. That's exactly right. And that's what Jesus is saying. So this gives me encouragement. Okay, I look at the things that are going on in the church today. You know, there are certain problems that just keep coming up over and over and over again in the church that I've noticed even in my lifetime. Things like marriage, divorce, and remarriage, instrumental music, women's participation in the church, those types of things. Those things come up over and over and over again. And why they come up over and over again is because they're valuable tools that the devil is using. Okay? He brings those things up again, and people jump on that, and, you know, and next thing we know, we go through this whole thing all over again. Okay? So the problems are there, and the devil knows our weaknesses, and so he works on us through those weaknesses. Okay. Why just seven letters then? There were more churches in Asia Minor than just these seven. You know, there was Colossae, and there was Miletus, and Troas, or not Troas, Troas was somewhere. One of those others down there starts with a T. Look it up. Why just seven? Why not all of them? You what? Well, that's a good point. That number seven comes up. That number seven, you're going to see it 56 times in the book of Revelation. 56 times. So it's a pretty important number. Okay. And so that needs to help us to understand that when that number comes, we need to think of either perfection or completeness or thoroughness or something along those lines. Okay. So, yeah, that's a good idea. I don't know if you've got maps in the back of your Bibles, but, I've got some study Bibles, and I know you can't see this, but I printed one out so I could follow it along. But the island of Patmos is out there in the Aegean Sea. Aegean Sea is kind of a little inlet off of the Mediterranean up between Greece and Asia Minor there. And island of Patmos is down here. And that's where Paul is, or I keep saying Paul, that's where John is at this time, okay? And directly kind of northeast of Ephesus, when you get to the mainland, is the city of Ephesus. And Ephesus is on a road that Rome built to all the important trade centers that were known at that time. And amazingly, if you follow this road, it follows the order in which these letters were written. Okay? So you go, if you go to Ephesus, which would be where Paul would, don't mind when I do that, where John wrote the letter. I'm going to say Paul a lot, but just remember, I mean John, okay? Okay. So when John wrote this letter, it would go first to Ephesus, because that was the capital, and then it would follow this road. It would go up north to Smyrna, and then up further north to Pergamum. Then it would go kind of southwest over to Thyatira, and then turn directly south and go down to Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, and then back over to Ephesus. That was kind of a loop, we might call it there, that the trade routes took. They also use that for mail delivery, okay? So if you find a Bible, you can kind of follow that. I don't know that that's why these churches were there, but I think it's important, okay, John and Christ used this to distribute these letters. But here's what I think is the main thing we need to remember, is that these seven churches are merely representatives of the things that are going on throughout the Christian community at that time. Okay. When he writes these letters, he's going to follow the same format every time. First, he'll introduce himself, using one of the phrases from this description over in chapter 1. Okay. And then he's going to praise these churches for the good things that they've done, save one, which would be what church? What's the church that didn't get any commendation? Laodicea. Laodicea. You haven't ever heard the lesson? I know you've heard the lesson. I'll spew you out of my mouth. I wish that you were either hot or cold, but I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. I mean, you've heard those lessons, haven't you? That's Laodicea. Okay. There was two that he had nothing bad to say about, even though they had some problems. Okay. But the other ones, they follow the same line. He would praise them. He would commend them for the good things they're doing. And then he would say, but. But you've got some things going on here. All right. And then he gives to them a commendation which says, remain faithful. Okay. And, you know, you'll win the crown of life, or you'll receive the white stone or the new name or something like that. But that's kind of the progression which he takes. All right. Well, what lessons can we learn from this? We've created another problem by putting this on the outside, but what lessons can we learn from this? These letters to these seven churches. Huh? They fit us exactly. They fit every church that has ever existed and ever will exist. And you know what that tells me? Every church has its problems. Okay? There is no such thing as a perfect church. No, mankind hasn't. Okay? Think all the way back to the, some people like to call it the ancient church or the mother church in Jerusalem, the church that was established there on the day of Pentecost. Do they have any problems there? You ever heard of somebody called Ananias and Sapphira? You're right. It was. They had a problem there also with the Grecian widows. Remember about that? Were being neglected in the daily distribution. But they had their problems. Okay, they had to deal with those things. All right. What about Paul when he went on his missionary journeys, establishing all these churches? Were they perfect churches? If they were, why did he have to write so many letters? Okay, he wrote all these letters, these epistles, to all these churches that had problems. Okay? Every church that has ever existed has problems. You think somewhere we find the perfect church in all this, don't you? But it just didn't happen. Okay. So that's why he wrote each of these letters. Each church didn't have the same problem. They had different problems. Okay? And so he addressed those problems, you know, and told them of the rewards or the consequences if they don't do what they're supposed to do. And that was simply was that I'm going to come and remove your lampstand. That's what chapter 1 said. Those seven lampstands represented these seven churches. Okay? Remember we talk about the coming. Sometimes you see in Revelation that Jesus talking about coming, that could be the second coming. But that's not always the second coming. Because here he says, if you don't straighten up, I'm going to come and remove your lampstand. That has nothing to do with the second coming, right? What does that have to do with? You're not going to be a church anymore. You're not going to be a church anymore. So that's all it amounts to. Okay. All right. There's some things that we can see that I think are interesting about these seven churches. I want to talk about four or five of them here. But through reading through them, I think we can see these things. Basically, in these churches, there is an absence of what we would call the ecclesiastic organization that comes about in the church. I want to talk about the ecclesiastic. That's a term that we use. It basically amounts to church organization and church leadership and things like that. When John writes this letter to these churches, who is he writing to? Who is it addressed to? It's addressed to the angel of the church. Now, that we don't know. We're not told who that angel is. It may not be an individual. It could be. Most commentators think that it was the church itself. And basically, that's who these letters were written to. They were written to the church. Okay? It was not written to some bishop. It was not written to a pope. It was not written to some hierarchy in the church. It was written to the church. Okay? So what does that tell us about the early church that we can learn today? Well, first of all, that each church was individual. Okay, there was an individuality. And a lot of times, it's spoken of in that way. Paul said, the churches of Christ salute you. That's churches. Okay. Over here, in a lot of times in the book of Revelation, he's going to talk about the churches. Okay. And other times, it's individual when we talk about Jesus is the head of the church. Okay. But what do we gain from that? We have all these individual churches, okay, who compose one body. Okay. However, there is not one big guy over the body, other than Christ Himself, that has the authority to tell churches what to do and how to do it. Okay? So we see that from reading these seven letters. There was nobody there like that. No, they're not even addressed. They're not talked about. They didn't exist. Okay? And we're about maybe 65 years removed from Pentecost here. We say Pentecost was 33 A.D. or somewhere along there. We don't know exactly how long. And John wrote this letter in 95. And that's, we'll just say 65 years. Okay? The church in Ephesus, if we do go back and look from when it was written, it's probably one of the oldest churches, and it's about 40 years old when this is written. Okay? So they've been around for a while, but they're not ancient churches, okay, but they've been around for a while, and they have not developed this sense of, you know, like the world sees it, this pyramid thing, like bishops and cardinals and popes and those types of things, where we got the head up here telling everybody else, you know, what to do and so on and so forth. It didn't exist, okay? So that's not going to come along for another 150 years. So we don't have that, okay? Something else that we see that kind of goes along with this is the fact that there is no bishop or overlord over any of these churches. It's addressed to the angel, okay? And the angel is a basically what like I said, most commentators think is that they are the members of the church. The angel is the I don't know how to say this, the thought, the idea, the body, the common union of the church members. I mean, that's the way many look at it. So that's the way it is. And Christ alone is the head of the church. Okay. Something else we see about this, and it's still going along the same line of thinking, is that there is a simplicity to the organization of the church. Now, we say a lot of times the church is not a democracy. We're not ruled by majority rules, okay? And that's true. That's not how the church is set up. But, in a sense, we are, okay? For example, how do we select in our congregation those whom we choose to, I don't like to use that word, rule over us. That's not a good word, because that implies shepherd, leaders. Let's look at it that way. How do we choose those that do that? We just went through this. How did we do it? Yeah. You, as members, you know, you choose who you want to be your shepherd. Okay? Now, there's guidelines for that. Okay? There's guidelines for that. And we're going to make sure that that's done properly. But we just went through this process, and of course, it was just Bobby and I at the time that were taking all these things, and we could not say, ain't gonna have him. Ain't gonna have him. Every name that was put in there, okay, we talked to them. Okay, there were some that said, I don't feel qualified. I don't want to do that. You know, we're not at this time. That's fine. Okay, all right. So we moved on to those that were. And we had five that agreed that, yes, we'll sit, and they met the qualifications. I, as a serving elder, have no right to say, uh-uh. You know, That's not something that's given to me. That's not my authority. I'm not an overlord. I'm not a bishop of the church. Well, technically we are, but I don't like to use that. Think of that thing in worldly terms, you know, that this bishop who rules over a bunch of churches, that's not the idea. What I'm saying is, you, as individual Christians, you have a say in who serves over you, who shepherds over you. Okay? That's what it's all about. So that brings us in the individuality of each church. And each church does their own thing. Okay? Nobody goes over here and tells them what to do or how to do things. That's beyond us. So we see that in all of these churches, because when these letters are written, they're written individually to each of these churches and telling them to deal with their own problems. Okay, now, something else we see in these letters is that each congregation had some weaknesses, they had some frailties that needed to be addressed. Now, I've got a point in where I'm going with all this, so hang with me. We may not even get to these letters today, but they'll help us in understanding them a little bit better. Okay. We're going to see, and we might as well mention it now, because when we get to them, you know what we're talking about. The church in Ephesus is commended for the fact that they would not put up with the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Okay, we're going to get over to Smyrna, and they're going to be not commended for the fact that they allowed the Nicolaitans to operate within their church. Okay, and we got Nicolaitans working in about three different churches, probably more than that, because they're very active in the world at this time. We'll talk a little bit about them. Also, he says, I have this against you, that you have some in your church that are holding to the teaching of Balaam. Okay, do you remember who Balaam was? We've got to go back to the Old Testament to pull this out. Balaam was, some people think he was a false prophet, but that's not what the Scripture tells us. The Scripture tells us he was a prophet of God. He was living over in Moab, and Balak was the king at that time. Now, they're watching the Israeli army coming. You know, they've crossed the Red Sea, and they're on their way to the Promised Land, and they're wiping out all these people on their way, and Moab's next on the list. You remember what Balak did? He went and grabbed Balaam and said, come and curse these people for me. He thought he had some special power, and Balaam told him what? I can't unless God gives me permission. So he went and asked God. And God turned it around, and not only did he not curse them, but he gave them a blessing. That happened on a couple of different occasions, all right? And so Balak, the king, got mad, you know, and he said, well, what good are you to me? All right? Well, now Balaam was being paid money for his services. And so the money kind of overtook him. And he said, well, look, let's do this. I can't curse them, but what you do is you go down there and you entice these Moabite women to intermingle with these Hebrew men, okay, and you guys intermarry and get them to worship your gods, you know, and they did. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about Balak or Balaam. He wasn't allowed to curse them, but he encouraged them to mingle with the enemy, so to speak, okay. So as a result of that, when the destruction came to Moab, Balaam lost his life and all of that, okay. So that's the idea, is that this idea of enticement. There are those in the church who encourage the idea of what Balaam told to Moab. Told them to, you know, go over and rub shoulders with these people. Participate in their worshiping of their gods and so forth. So, you know, that was one of the problems that they were dealing with. Very closely related with the Nicolaitans. Okay. The Nicolaitans basically held to what we call Gnosticism, and I don't want to get into all that, but the Gnostics basically thought that when Jesus came to earth, he was not actually in the physical body, he just appeared to be. So in other words, they're taken away from the idea of the incarnation of Jesus. And then they also taught that as far as the body and the soul is concerned, there's nothing that the body can do that can harm the soul. Okay, so you can go out there and do what you want to. You know, go out on Saturday night and have a good time, you know. Incest, drinking, whatever you want to do, carousing, it can't hurt your soul. Okay, so that's part of what the Nicolaitans were teaching. Okay, that same idea, which goes right along with the idea of Balaam, okay, the followings of Balaam. And then and we get another one of the letters. They bring in Jezebel, okay. They said, you've got a Jezebel in your church. Her name probably wasn't Jezebel, but that's what they referred to, because they would know who they were talking about. Who was Jezebel? She was a queen of Ahab over in the Old Testament, you know. You know of anybody that names their daughter Jezebel today? No. No, nobody does, because this was one wicked lady. Elijah, I get it mixed up. It was Elijah. Okay. Remember he had that confrontation with the prophets of Baal over on Mount Carmel and slew all those guys? And because of that, Jezebel chased after him, you know, told him, said, before this day is over with, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to do to you just like you did to my prophets. And boy, he got scared and ran away. And that's a whole other story. But anyway, she was so dead set to have her way on everything that she was willing to do anything she could. Wicked, wicked lady. Now, she followed the worship of some Phoenician gods. You'll hear about them all the time. Baal, okay, that was the male god. You hear different ways. Anytime you see that word Baal, it could be Baal Peor or Baal whatever. Baal is this Phoenician god. And then the female counterpart of that was Ashtaroth. Okay? And so you see those terms, those both refer to this Phoenician worship, the male and female, Baal and Ashtaroth. You see those out throughout the Old Testament scriptures all the time. And so she had set up all of these temples and all these idols throughout Israel, and insisted that people worship them, okay? And so she was drawing people away. And part of the worship to Baal and Ashtaroth was that they had the male and female prostitutes in the temple, and you were encouraged to go and do your worship by participating in prostitution. Okay? So that was their idea of worship. Okay. So, I said those things so that when we get to this, you'll understand what we're up against. And there were churches that were not promoting these things. They were not encouraging these things, but they had members in their congregations who were practicing those things, and they were being reprimanded for those. Okay? So that's going on. All right? Do we have things going on in our churches today that we allow to go on, which we shouldn't? This is a touchy subject. I'm gonna go ahead and spend some time talking about this for just a second. We talked about this Thursday morning a little bit at our prayer breakfast. I wasn't going to go this direction, but I'm going to just go ahead and say it right now. We do not have the right to stand at that door and police who comes through our door. Years ago, I know they don't do it now, but there were certain religious organizations that when you came into their door, if you were a known believer, practicing believer of their fellowship, they would give you a little coin or a token or whatever when you went in. And when they passed the communion, you could turn that coin over and they would give you communion. But if you didn't have that coin, you could not participate in communion. Okay? We don't do that. Why don't we? Yeah, that's not my job. That's not my job. Okay? Now, let's suppose we have a known practicing homosexual couple comes here and says, we want to place membership with this congregation. How do we handle that situation? Interesting, right? Do I have the right to say, you ain't coming in my door? You're not sitting next to my kids. Okay. Has God given me that authority? No, He has not. He has not given me that authority. However, that does not mean that I don't have to deal with the problem. Okay. And that involves teaching those individuals, encouraging those individuals, possibly disfellowshipping those members. Now, disfellowshipping doesn't mean kicking them out. You know, a lot of times we think about that, because I think that's what the Catholic Church is. If we disfellowship you, they kick you out. What does that mean? How do we disfellowship people? That just simply means outside this assembly, we don't go to the ball games with them. We don't go out to eat with them. We don't go play golf with them. Okay? And it's not that we're trying to shake our finger and go, shame on you, that type of thing. Well, maybe we are a little bit, but the idea is we're trying to get across the fact that those things are not acceptable, and if you want to be part of the fellowship, you're going to have to quit doing them. But I don't have the right to say, get out of here. Okay? Now, I said that because that kind of goes along with what we're doing. These churches had people in there that were doing things they shouldn't have been doing. And obviously, the rest of the membership was not handling those things properly. They were just allowing it to happen. Because they're commended for the fact that they did not participate in those things, and yet they allowed it to continue to go on. Okay? So, you get the idea of what we're up against here when we come to some of these letters? Does that make sense what I said to you this morning?
One of the things we always need to remember about the church is that whatever the activity, our ultimate goal is to save souls.
Exactly right.
And we can't ever lose sight of that.
Exactly right.
How can we influence the salvation of the soul if we don't have some kind of interaction?
And that's what we're all about.
Exactly.
Okay. And we can't do that if we say, out of here. No.
Even the concept of forgiveness, which I know some of you are, even the concept of forgiveness, if you look at all the scriptures dealing with forgiveness, has as its ultimate goal the salvation of that soul. Everything literally, even our song service, has as its goal influencing and admonishing Christians.
That is right. That is right. And that's what it's all about. And we're not police officers. God has not given us that authority. We're not lords or anything like that, you know. Our primary focus is the souls of those individuals, okay? Now, we're not going to condone what they're doing. If we do that, we're just as bad as some of these people are, okay? In fact, we have to let them know we don't accept this. This is not acceptable behavior. Now how does that work? We're given a guideline for that, haven't we? Okay, and we don't do it. But how does it work? We, okay, go to them and tell them. That's each and every one of us. And that's where we fail. We don't do that. You know, we say, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to judge anybody. I don't know how they're going to respond. You have that obligation, all right? If they don't accept what you say, what do? Get you a buddy and go again, okay? In twos. And you go again. If they don't accept that, thus saith the Lord for everything, okay? Because I'm not the judge. We want to show them where God is. Maybe I need some work to myself, you know, in my problem. So that, right. If that doesn't work, bring it to the church, okay? They go to them, and that doesn't work, disfellowship. Right, right, yeah. The reason disfellowship doesn't work in the church today is because we as a body don't practice it. It doesn't work if just one or two people do it. It has to be the whole body. Now, I know it works. I've only seen it done a couple of times. But one time was by a good friend of mine, and he had a good friend that got in a relationship he shouldn't have been in and got into the marriage and divorce and so forth like that, and the church disfellowshipped him. Now, he still came to work, to worship, and people, you know, it's not like we ignored him when he comes to worship. We still greeted him, but outside the church, he didn't have the fellowship, okay? They used to be avid golfers. They loved to play together. Now, see, here's a good commentary for golfing. Okay? Nobody agreed with me. They were very good. They played all the time. And my friend says, I can't play with you anymore. You know, until you straighten out, I can't play. And every once in a while, this guy would call him, and he'd say, I sure miss our golf time together. And he would say, I do too. I just wish we could do it again, but I can't. Okay? And it took about 6 months, but this guy finally got enough of it. And he straightened it out, his life, and he came back to the church. That is a good example of a church discipline working. But it only works if everybody does it. We need more of it. Because we're not trying to ridicule a person. We're not trying to hurt a person. We want them to straighten their lives out and get back to fellowship. Now, if they say, so what, you know, then we as a fellowship are doing something wrong that they don't want to be a part of us. Okay? We're out of time, so I'm just going to stay right where we're at. Okay. Here's the idea of what we're getting at and why we have all of these churches. Is that the church is made up of believers and it's made up of unregenerate sinners. Okay? Now what I'm saying, that's every congregation. They're there. Unregenerate sinners are part of the church. We see that because they're included in these letters. Okay? All right? Their name is in the book of life. Okay? But they're going to have to justify their name being there. In fact, we're told in some places that if you don't straighten out, your name's going to be blotted out of the book of life. Okay? Who has the right to do that? Who has the right to blot out? Only Christ has that right. Okay, that's not my right. Okay, so I follow what they've given to me. So we know that there are those here today that have problems. I'm one of them. I've got problems. I hope I'm not out here just bold-faced sinning, you know, but I make my mistakes. But that's why we have the church. You know, if I'm messing up, you know, I'm not going to, you know, throw a punch at you if you come to me and say, hey, man, you know, you need to straighten this out. You know, and if somebody does that to you, you need to say, thank you. Thank you for that and do it. Okay? Here's what I'm getting at, that every church has its problems. No church is perfect. We all have sinners in our church, but still it's Christ's church. It's still Christ's church. And in spite of all the problems that have gone on through all the years, even from the ancient church in Jerusalem, the church is still here.
I used to think about that quite a bit. You know, several years ago here, went through a pretty major split. And I got to thinking about the scriptures. And, you know, in the Bible, when there were problems, when did it cease becoming the Lord's church? It never did. It never ceased becoming the Lord's church because there were problems there. There were just problems there.
Yeah.
And to split like that and to think that you're going to be different is very short-sighted and ignorant, kind of.
Well,
because there's going to be problems there too.
I'm not saying there's never a time when you need to split, okay, because there could be a time when things are bad enough that you do need to do that. And I've seen that time in my life. But it shouldn't be an option just because you either do it my way or gone. You know, play the way I want to, or I'm going to take my ball and leave. You know, that's not an option. That's not our call. Okay? Okay. So God is still in control, and that's the message He's given to these churches. I thought we might get to one or two of them this morning, but got long-winded. We'll talk about Ephesus next week. We'll start there, and then we're just going to work our way around. These churches are right in order of the mail route. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, right on around. And we'll get two or three of them next week and then move on. Look at their problems, the things that they were doing right, the things that they weren't doing right, the rewards for doing things right, and the problem for not doing things right is that we'll take your candlestick away. And I know of churches that no longer exist because their candlestick were taken away. Okay? So it happens. Okay? All right, we're out of time. Comments? Questions? Okay, we'll pick it up here next week. Thank you for your time.